This is Art in Focus, brought to you by the McMullen Museum of Art at Boston College. My name is Sasha Chulgin, class of 2024 and a McMullen student ambassador. I'd like to welcome you in listening to the first episode in a series on the exhibition Gateway to Himalayan Art. This episode will feature a conversation between Boston College professors Matthew Vail and Yonder Gillihan, both of the theology department.
Okay. Hi, Yonder. It's good to be with you. I'm Matthew Vail. I teach in the theology department. I work in comparative theology, so I work on Christian theology in relation to Buddhist traditions, especially Indian and Tibetan Buddhism. I teach courses here at BC on Buddhist topics, but also on Christianity and Buddhism in dialogue. And I will turn it over to Yonder to introduce himself.
I'm Yonder Gillihan, and I'm a professor also in the theology department at BC. I teach in the Bible area, so my area of expertise is very different from Matthew's and also from the things that we're going to be talking about today. But while I work in Bible, I have recently done some comparative work on revelatory traditions and revelation and mysticism in Second Temple Judaism in comparison with some Tibetan practices, and I consulted with Professor Vail on that. So we're here continuing a conversation that has been ongoing for a while.
Yes. Well, so what are we going to look at today, Yonder? We have a sort of wild and forbidding image to look at. I don't know if you want to give us just a first blush look. What are we seeing here? What's on the canvas?
Boy, oh boy, that's a great question. As a biblical scholar who, you know, covers a lot of very colorful material from another ancient tradition, I'm fascinated by the exhibit at the McMullen right now. The Himalayan art contains alluring, tantalizing, you know, fascinating imagery. These gods are nothing like the gods that we meet in the Bible, with which I'm familiar. And in some ways, these images of are fear-inspiring in ways that I'm not sure that we have analogs in Christian art. So the foreignness of it really stands out to me from the perspective of a biblical scholar. And I was hoping to hear from you, actually. Could you just, like, tell me what are we looking at here? Like, what is Mahakala? And what is this object on which Mahakala appears?
Sure. So what we're looking at here is a Tibetan image of a god called Mahakala, whose name means the great dark one or the great black one. You can see he's black or dark blue. Sanskrit doesn't distinguish always between blue and black, and so Tibetan images also don't. This is an 18th century image. It's from the Sakya school of Tibetan Buddhism. It's painted on cloth. The cloth is painted black, and then the outlines are given in gold ink, so it's very striking. This is an image from Tantric or esoteric Buddhism, which is maybe not as esoteric as the name suggests. There are esoteric aspects to it, but a lot of Tibetan religion is really suffused by the elements of esoteric Buddhism. So practices and images like these, maybe not exactly like this image, would suffuse a lot of more public religious life in Tibet. There are some more, you might say, exoteric meanings or practices associated with this image. Mahakala is one of the so-called protectors, and this is a wrathful form. So Mahakala might be invoked to protect a ritual or to protect a text or to protect a place or to protect someone while traveling, so on. But in a more maybe esoteric vein, Mahakala might be used as the central meditational deity that one would focus on in a more intensive meditative setting. One would use an image like this to create a very vivid mental visualization of Mahakala and then do certain practices in relation to this image. One would commit all the details of an image such as this one to memory and then use that visualization as a basis for a very vivid sense of Mahakala's presence and the presence of all the other deities in the image.
So in the practice, would you begin by memorizing, by becoming familiar with Mahakala, by looking at this image, by memorizing, and then would you set the image aside during your meditation practice and simply call to mind the details that you've memorized?
I think maybe both. I'm not sure I'd be the one to answer that question. I'm just realizing, Yonder, we forgot to give our like disclaimer at the beginning about who we are and like what by what possible authority we dare to speak of Mahakala. So maybe we should say that just now. Both Yonder and I, I'll let Yonder speak for himself too, have some experience with contemplative practices, both Christian and Buddhist. Are friends with a lot of lamas and practicing Buddhists in the area. Lots. What am I saying? are friends with some great Buddhist teachers and practitioners in the area. It's a part of my research, and though I can't claim to know these things exactly from the inside, I've spent a lot of time thinking about them as a Christian, trying to understand them and understand them in relation to Christianity. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. There's obviously a sort of insider experiential dimension to these images and practices that I can't exactly speak to, but I can speak to what I've gleaned from them, trying to make sense of them as a Christian. How about you, Yonder?
Well, in conversation with friends within Buddhist sanghas in the area, especially like a Notre Dame Fellowship and some of the groups that meet around John McCransky's teachings, I've become familiar with some aspects of these traditions, and what little I've gleaned, I'm really excited to learn more about, you know, through this conversation, and not just through this conversation, but really through visiting the gallery. And there's something so valuable about going there and sitting with the objects that we often hear about, you know, as though they're distant.
Definitely, yeah. And an object like this, the colors, although they're dark, are very intense and make quite an impression on you. Just to get a sense of what this image is about, let me just read a description of it that a great scholar of these things, Jeff Watts, who has an online database called Himalayan Art Resources, pulled out from a Sakya figure called Ngorchen Gunjok Lundrup. This is a 15th, 16th century figure. This is what he says about the image. The great Vajra Mahakala blazes with one face, two hands, holding in the right a curved knife and in the left a skull cup filled with blood, held above and below the heart. Across the middle of the two forearms is the Gandhi of emanation, so that like staff laying across his arms. With three eyes, bared fangs, yellow hair flowing upward, he has a crown of five dry human skulls and a necklace of 50 wet skulls, dripping blood. Adorned with six bone ornaments and snakes, having a lower garment of tiger skin, flowing with pendants and streamers of various silks, in a posture dwarfish and thick, he stands above a corpse. Let me just point to a few things we see here. Above him, there's a dark blue figure immediately above him. That's the sort of primordial Buddha Vajradhara. Over in the upper left-hand corner, there's another form of a related deity who has a buffalo face and is riding on a buffalo, surrounded in flames. Sort of lower down towards the lower right-hand corner, we've got a female Mahakali riding on a mule, also sort of engulfed in this fire, holding a spear and a sword and a trident. The descriptions one often hears of these flames around Mahakala are, this is the sort of radiant flame of pristine awareness or of Buddhahood itself. So if you can imagine it, this intense, wrathful figure with so many fearsome things in the image, a skull cup with human blood and a flaying knife, is somehow sort of radiant with or encompassed by or radiating the intrinsic purity of awakened mind.
So thank you for that description. I'm so impressed looking at this at just how scary the imagery that's here is. We've got five dried skulls on top of Mahakala's face, and then 50 freshly severed heads that he's wearing as ornaments. Now, what I understand from the tradition is that this is not a demon or a devil. While it's a protector, perhaps of sacred texts or objects, it's also a compassionate protector whose nature is considered to be compassion for beings.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so this is fascinating. When practitioners look at this deity, are they to be terrified? Are they to feel compassion? How do those two go together?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can speak to that in the way a practitioner from within this tradition could. I could just say something like, what I sense when I ponder this image is something like, what I thought was fearful turns out to be a protector. Or what I thought was an enemy, something I had to be terrified of, turns out to be an expression of this pristine, radiant awareness, or is like an emanation or a gift or a communication from something that's utterly good and safe, but it's taking this very unexpected form.
Mm-hmm.
That this is somehow an emanation of Buddhahood itself,
right,
of my own sort of primordial nature, but in a form that I might not recognize it in initially. Something like this.
So this is not coming from the outside, this is coming from the inside. This is an expression of my own primordial Buddha nature.
That, well, you know, we've had lots of conversations about this hermeneutic principle in Tibetan texts of an outer and inner and a secret meaning, and that would be the sort of inmost or secret meaning, I suppose, that Mahakala and whatever else Mahakala represents would be a sort of expression of Buddha nature, of the pristine nature of my own awareness as liberation and Buddhahood and supreme peace and ease and so on.
Right. So those energies, and I guess here what we're looking at is an expression of a powerful energy that's common in human experience. Like every mind knows the experience of being overwhelmed with anger or fear or some kind of negative emotion. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I want to hear what you have to say about this too. But yeah, I think of from what I've gathered from the tradition and from my own way of pondering this as a Christian, an image like Mahakala is something like the sort of sheer, like raw aliveness or energy of something like anger or fear or even jealousy or clinging, that actually there's some respect in which these emotions, with which otherwise might terrify us or entangle us, are actually just this kind of in itself powerful and useful and ultimately kind of good and helpful, just raw aliveness of what we are as minds somehow.
When the raw aliveness of our mind, the creative power, manifests in ways that might disturb us, like anger or jealousy or so on, we can recognize them as a Mahakala. It looks scary, but it's actually an expression of a harmless, pure energy of enlightenment. And in that way, there's nothing, if we recognize it as such, then we lose the basis of our fear.
I would love to hear your thoughts. How do I do that? Like, everyone knows what it's like to be in the grip of anger or fear or jealousy or like compulsively being down on yourself. How do I, in the grip of that, recognize it as this kind of sort of, as I've heard many practicing Tibetan Buddhists say, sort of liberated energy rather than anger that tangles me up and hurts me and hurts others? How do I just recognize it as this expression of this raw alive, or this basic aliveness?
That's a wonderful question. I feel like maybe simply having the teaching there first is a way to begin the process of recognition. So, you know, you have a teacher who explains this to you. This is an expression of your own intrinsic radiant awareness. It feels disturbing, but it's actually pure. It's actually coming from your mind. Like, if you just get that from your teacher, maybe having that knowledge to turn to affords a little bit of relief the next time anger comes up. But it seems like there's something often, you know, that you hear in the teachings about simply allowing the disturbing emotion to arise and to dwell for as long as it needs to, and then to pass when it's ready. So in that case, just for no reason, you might suddenly feel angry or jealous or insecure. And remembering this image, as I understand it, this principle, reminds you that that energy will just go right back into the mind from which it came. And the one who is observing it will continue to observe all experience without changing, without being affected, without becoming impure, simply as a result of witnessing this. Well, two metaphors that I've heard that might answer the question, what do you do? One is be like the sky. Allow the emotion to pass like a bird passing across the sky, leaving no trace. And another is to be like a door frame. Not with a closed door, but just like a door frame. And through a door frame, anyone who wishes to come and go comes and goes. You're just a door frame. You let them come, you let them go. And you remain the frame.
There's something very profound here in some imagery or some of the kind of lore or deeper meanings associated with this image. I don't know if this is true of this Mahakala, but often Mahakala is thought of as an emanation of Akshobhya Buddha, who's like one of these primordial Buddhas. And Akshobhya means the immovable. So this sort of like raw, vibrant, at times disturbing, rambunctious energy of anger or jealousy or fear or whatever, like you were saying, is actually kind of ultimately grounded in and resolves into and issues from this immovable, this unshakable joy, I would say. That's the way, as a Christian, I think of what Buddhahood is. It's just unshakable, unconditioned joy. So yeah, it would be very profound to start thinking of my disturbing emotions as merely the sort of like manifesting energy of what is this unshakable joy. Can I tell a little story that I think that is just occurring to me that I think like exemplifies this? I have small children and I love them. They are 5 and 3. But often you can get in these kind of like loggerhead situations where we need to get pajamas on, we need to brush teeth, but there's this tiny but indomitable will that doesn't want to get pajamas on and doesn't want to brush teeth. And actually it was after having a similar conversation with you, Yonder, that I had the very vivid experience of almost getting into loggerheads with one of my children about getting pajamas on. And Dad's stipulation that it had to be just in this way. And I was starting to get angry. And all of a sudden something turned, like and he was starting to get angry too. And we were starting to get like sort of locked in this like rivalry of like one of us has to win. And somehow I just kind of like caught this like glimmer in his eye, or like what you said recurred to me. And I just realized like, well, Mahakala is trampling a corpse. And I just thought, what would it be if just the energy of this situation just got to like trample my dumb plan about how the pajamas had to get on? Like, what if Mahakala, you know, engulfed in flames, just like rode in here on a mule and destroyed that plan?
It sounds like it happened.
And something just switched, and all of a sudden, all of the energy buildup towards getting angry was suddenly energy buildup towards, although it's the end of the day, I'm tired, my back hurts, all of a sudden this upsurge of energy that was going to become anger then becomes like, let's play this game. Do you want to walk into your bedroom on your hands or on your feet? On my hands! And so then all of a sudden, like that upsurge that was going to be anger in a way that I was so grateful for and kind of in awe of, like became the sort of creative energy of connecting with him and the creative energy of love. I think about
that's
that.
That's beautiful. Yeah, it's practical.
Like this sort of like energy that's rising in you, the way it ultimately wants to find expression is through connection or through letting something happen that you weren't going to let happen. but that was more good and beautiful than what you had in mind.
Yeah, I love that. The wrathful deities, in my opinion, are one of the most genius contributions of this whole tradition to, you know, sort of human well-being. Like, what you just described was something I think everyone can relate to. And as it turns out, I think everyone can relate to a feeling of being overwhelmed by a negative emotion at a time when you've got plans and you're sure they're going to work and you know that you're going to be happy if they work out. Like, all those plans are that corpse, like you mentioned. Those are our sense of well-being and all the plans we had for each other. And situations come along when suddenly it all goes to pieces. And when it goes to pieces, it feels disturbing, but that disturbance is actually a protective deity that, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that I love how this takes a common experience that all humans have of having their plans upset. And it tells you that's actually good, because when your plans are upset, you get to see how much you're holding on to your plans. And you get to see how much you're clinging to a certain way that life has to be in order for you to be happy. The Maha Kala comes along and says, what if it doesn't work out that way? Can you still be happy? And this furious, radiant, you know, wrathful goddess or god reminds the observer, find lasting happiness. Don't seek happiness in those things that are so fickle and perishable.
Like getting pajamas put on in exactly this way.
You could say, yes.
I'm going to have a crummy evening unless,
right.
Unless everyone under six obeys me exactly and immediately. That's, by the way, the same as saying, I'm going to have a crummy evening.
another thing that this, like, this is reminding me of is one teaching that John McCransky has offered several times. He teaches that the emotions that we often experience as isolating, like anger or jealousy or fear, are universally felt by all humans. Every person knows what it's like to be jealous or to have fear or terror. And when we connect to the principle, like when we realize that these energies are present for our benefit, they're actually there to help steer us into good things and away from bad things, and every human has them. Once we recognize that, it becomes possible to experience something that's usually isolating as a source of profound connection to others. And I, you know, like when you're mad, maybe you want to go sit in the dark and just burn. And this reminds you that sitting in the dark and burning is something that all people go through. And when you're feeling that way, you're connected to everyone who's, you know, ever felt that way. Not just in your wish, not just in your suffering, but also in your wish to be free from it.
I think what's very powerful and helpful about that is that all the storylines that usually come with a negative emotion are kind of fueled by some basic feeling of isolation or powerlessness or whatever, right? Like, this feeling of like, who do they think they are? Or like, I'll show them. Or even like, what the hell's the matter with me? I'm never going to get it together. Like, somehow at the root of all of those things is like, this thing has utterly isolated me and made me completely powerless. As you were saying, being able to touch into the sort of like basicness and sharedness of this experience and of that very sentiment, as well as, like we were saying before, being able to sense really vividly in the moment that what is upsurging in me is not actually my powerlessness, but kind of like the fullness and fulsomeness and energetic and intensely alive quality of what I am, that in itself almost like eviscerates the feeling of powerlessness that, for me anyways, is at the root of an angry reaction. Like, I need to lash out because I somehow need to guarantee my power over this situation. But somehow, if my anger is actually like Mahakala, and it's this kind of just fierce aliveness of the mind's nature, then it feels okay to just sort of feel that and sort of enjoy and rest in the fullness of that without needing to then like do something to make five-year-olds brush their teeth.
So one thing that, so as we're talking, you know, it seems clear that one lesson that a viewer might get from this image and from the tradition of the wrathful deities is that those things that seem terrifying and that really disrupt our lives can actually be viewed as pure and as expressions of compassion and as beneficial to us. I think that that's kind of we can generalize that at least in about this Tibetan stuff. Looking at it that way made me wonder, what in the Bible do we find that might be analogous? Like, do we find portraits of God as wrathful and compassionate, or as, you know, fear-inspiring and yet wise? And I found actually a lot more than I expected. I was really surprised once I kind of put on those glasses, you know, how many things popped up. Like, throughout the prophets, we find declarations that God's wrath is coming. God's wrath will be poured out upon God's people as an expression of God's deep compassion and love, because God wishes to correct the errors that have arisen among the people. So like in Isaiah 54, we find compassion and wrath. For a brief moment, I abandon you, but with great compassion, I will gather you. In overflowing wrath for a moment, I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love, I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. Here, the eternal nature of God's relationship to humanity is compassion and love. And within the container of that eternal relationship, that compassion and love, occasionally wrath will come up. And it seems like it is kind of being presented as a skillful means, or, you know, as a means that God uses to fully express compassion and love in a way that shapes the people and makes them into what they can fully become.
It's an expression of compassion, you mean? It's a way of bringing about a compassionate end.
You could say so, but I have the sense that there's never, like, God never says, I stopped having compassion on you in the Bible. I stopped and now I'm back. You know, but in compassion is eternal, and for a moment there was overflowing wrath. We also get the theme throughout the Bible, in Job, in Proverbs, in the Psalms, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So there we have another like powerful, disturbing emotion associated with a very positive insight. And one more in Psalm 2, the one who terrifies us, the one who terrifies the rulers of the world, is the one in whom human beings must find refuge. Now, therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, with trembling. Kiss his feet, or he will be angry, and you will perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Happy are all who take refuge in him. Their wrath and refuge from the same source.
This reminds me of some of the sermons of George MacDonald, the great Scottish fantasy writer and preacher and theologian, who picks this biblical language up that God's love is a consuming fire. And it's so indomitable and unrestricted and inexhaustible that it won't stop until it burns up everything that harms and hampers the creatures that God loves. God won't stop at anything until everything that keeps creatures in fetters has been utterly consumed by the fire of love. That makes me think of Mahakala also. Of course, yeah, in that Tibetan setting, what Mahakala is wrathfully energetically engaged against is everything that obstructs liberation and awakening. So ultimately everything that harms beings, rather than being against, sort of wrathful against beings as such, wrathfully engaged against everything that obstructs and harms beings.
Now, it's my impression that Mahakala is an expression of and an emanation of other deities who have non-wrathful forms. Is that right?
Right.
So, yeah. So Mahakala might be known as Vajrasattva in some contexts, a Buddha of absolute purity who sits serenely observing with a brilliant white body. Or with an
and purifies all faults and is sort of associated with mercy and compassion. And,
right.
Yeah.
So the fact that Mahakala is a wrathful version of peaceful deities reminds me of this great scene in the Book of Revelation. And that is where the Prince of Peace, baby Jesus, the Lamb of God, gets on a horse in wrathful form. This is in Revelation chapter 19, and the full passage is Revelation 19, 11 to 21. But here's the key verse. From his mouth, this is Jesus, from his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. He will tread the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God the Almighty. That's Jesus.
Yeah, right. That's also the one seated on the white horse whose cloak is dipped in blood, whose name is the Logos of God, the Word of God. Yeah. This reminds me, though, of Jesus cleansing the temple. Like, Jesus storms into the temple in the Gospels with a whip made of cords, and he overturns the tables of the money changers who are cheating the poor people. So, again, it's like this wrathful compassion that intensively is engaged against what is, in this case, oppressing and hindering beings, but also against the hardness of heart of the very money changers whose tables he's flipping over. Like, the intensity of his compassionate will to liberate them from their own sort of narrowness of heart and their own inability to live in common cause with other human beings. That's what he's wrathfully engaged against. So I love you pointing that out. We get a wrathful emanation of Jesus in the New Testament.
it seems like there's also a sense in which how you respond to wrathful Jesus perfectly, you know, like situates you on the right side or the wrong side. So we have the wrathful Jesus in the temple cleansing scene, like you said. And in the Gospel of Mark, immediately after that, the authorities go out to plot against him, to kill him. But you also get in the Gospels the scene, another sort of version of the wrathful Jesus is when he meets the Syrophoenician woman and she asks him to heal her daughter. And he said, "I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel, and it is not right to give the children's food to the dogs." So that's a very harsh thing to say to a woman who's asking for help for her child. And yet she doesn't go away and ask for, you know, to tell stories about Jesus. She asks Jesus to, she continues asking, and she says, you know, even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the master's table. This humble response motivates Jesus to heal her daughter. And on the other hand, those who responded to Jesus by plotting against him remain, you know, the famous enemies of Jesus in the tradition. Whereas this woman who responded to Jesus' wrathful response so gently is a hero.
That's wonderful, yeah. I think it's worth saying explicitly, it's wonderful how reflecting on this Tibetan image can illuminate this greater richness in the Gospels that we might not have, maybe some of our listeners might not have noticed. Well, as we're wrapping up here, I would be curious to hear, Yonder, whether there are any takeaways you would bring together and tie a nice bow around, or maybe things that you might use this image to communicate in your teaching, or things that students or other visitors at the museum might take away from it?
From my limited perspective, from as a Bible scholar, but also as someone who really wants to find the useful aspects of religion and, you know, to make theology practical, I feel I would love for viewers of this Tonka and for readers of the Bible to take away a very simple and direct message from the deity of the Bible and the deity of this Tonka, and that is, fear not. Be not afraid. The traditions teach this in different ways, but certainly this, the message of the Mahakala seems to be, don't be afraid of your own strong emotions. They're natural, they're here to help you, and you can trust their source. And similarly, you know, when it feels like a God has stomped on your plans and you're being forced to rethink things, pay attention, because maybe there's grace and goodness that's operative, that you'll be able to see in a while with patience. Hopefully it helps with finals.
That's marvelous. One thing that comes to mind looking at Mahakala as a Christian, it makes me think of those Christians who, even amid really terrible suffering and injustice, are somehow able to experience everything as kind of inexplicably bathed in and supported by the love of God. That somehow in all of this, that this unrestricted act of love that's indomitable is somehow working in all things and working all things to the good. That not that this makes evil and injustice somehow stop being evil and unjust, but that somehow there's this unfathomable and indomitable love that's working in all these things and somehow overcoming evil in these things, overcoming what seems to be evil, bringing good out of evil. I was thinking, preparing for this podcast conversation, of a story of a, I can't remember if it was Romanian or Croatian priest who was held in a sort of totalitarian prison, and he was put in a cell with these hardened murderers in the guards' hope that these guys would kill him. And he had this experience of seeing these two hardened criminals in his cell, like radiant with the light of God. And he starts talking about them from then on as these like precious gifts of God to him. And their whole relationship turns into these men realizing that there is such a thing as like genuine divine love in the universe, because here's this person who should hate them, but who is gentle towards them. And it softens their heart and changes them utterly. And so this experience that seemed like there was only evil and injustice in it somehow turned into an expression of this powerful and unfathomable love working secretly in all things. I don't know, I think of that when I think of Mahakala.
That's wonderful. Well, in order to get there, in order to see the divine presence in those people, in his cellmates, he had to accept the terror that he was feeling and not run away from it, and not try to get into a different cell, and not try to like beat them up or whatever. He had to live with the feeling of being there with them. And only then could the clarity arise.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything more to say about it. It's almost like too deep. I dare not kind of tread on that sacred ground. But yeah, I wish I could remember this fellow's name. The account stands out to me so vividly. But he talks about this sort of vivid terror of death and asking, like, how could I possibly, I know I have to love these men and know them to be lovable, but how could I possibly do that? Anyway, I just find that so striking, him being able to speak about these men as radiant with divine light and precious gifts.
Well, it's called practice for a reason. You're just warming up.
That goes way beyond my experience. If I can manage just not to get mad at 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds who need to brush their teeth, I feel like I've had a profoundly awakened day.
So it's been great to explore this with you today, Matthew. And I look forward to going over other pieces, although we probably won't do it in this format.
Yeah, we'll keep talking. Thank you, Yonder. Really enjoyed this.
That concludes this episode of Art in Focus. Thank you for listening. And be sure to visit The Terrace, the McMullen Student Publications page, to find more episodes in this series. This episode was produced by Rachel Brody, the McMullen Graduate Assistant and a doctoral candidate in the History Department. It was mixed and edited by Sasha Chulgen. Thanks to Rachel Chamberlain, the McMullen Manager of Education, for her guidance and support. Finally, thank you to our podcast team.